Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, in for Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. State reaction to this week's White House scandals falls along political lines. New primary election polls reveal New Hampshire voters unfamiliar with most candidates running for Congress. And the state's northernmost city joins a lawsuit against the producers of opioid-based medicines. It's these stories and more on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today. Also, we meet 2nd Congressional District candidate Steve Negrin, a Republican from Nashua. As always, we welcome your input. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. And you can also watch our show on Facebook Live today. With me in studio, Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome, a Manchester Inklink, an in-depth NH series that explores stories from the New Hampshire State House. And hi, Gary, it's great to see you.
Great to see you, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. Dean, always good to have you. Thank you so much.
Hi, Laura. Glad to be here.
Well, Dean, I want to start with you. When there's huge national news like there was this week, state leaders here in New Hampshire are often asked for their reaction. So how did New Hampshire's congressional delegation, Dean, react to the news this week about jury convictions of President Trump's former campaign manager and the guilty plea by his lawyer?
Yeah, it's the reaction within the state was predictably along party lines. Governor Sununu continued to express support for President Trump, and our all-Democratic congressional delegation was not surprisingly quite critical. And in particular, Senators Shaheen and Hassan channeled some of this into the upcoming confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, basically, as Democrats have taken up this argument that those hearings, which were scheduled for coming up very soon, to try to get Kavanaugh on the bench for the beginning of the session in October, those hearings should be postponed as a result of this. And there's also
what's the thinking there, Dean? Sorry to interrupt
you,
but you know, one might look at this and say, okay, these are two separate processes. One is, you know, scandals among Trump associates, and the other is the usual Supreme Court process. So why are they linking
I think because they're looking for a means by which they could delay getting Kavanaugh on the court. You know, I mean, basically, it's politics. I think if Republicans, if the situation were reversed and you had a Democratic president facing these kinds of legal challenges, your Republicans would do their best to try to stop a Democratic nominee. I mean, there's still a lot of bad blood over the Merrick Garland episode with the end of President Obama's last term. You know, changes in the rules in the Senate have now made it that you can confirm a Supreme Court nominee with just a simple majority vote, which, you know, in reality makes it very difficult for Democrats to do anything. But they're trying different strategies, and this is one strategy. And, you know, one subplot here is Democrats have expressed some concern that Brett Kavanaugh has a very expansive notion of presidential power and whether or not presidents can even be bothered by any of this while they're in office. Can you indict a sitting president, et cetera? So they're concerned about that. There's a struggle with Republicans in the Senate and the National Archives over getting access to Kavanaugh's papers from when he was one of the key drafters of the Starr Report. Remember back with Ken Starr?
And I do remember, actually. Yeah.
All of us were around then. And so there's some concern that Democrats are not going to have access to everything.
So, Dean, if you can, for us, keep an eye on how New Hampshire's delegation has been responding to these, especially as these Kavanaugh hearings begin, that would be helpful. What about Governor Sununu, though, Dean? You know, he has said, I think, something like, we're not going to let the, I can't remember how he put it, difficulties in Washington affect the progress we're making here in the Granite
State. Yeah, we've talked about his relationship with the Trump administration on the roundup many times, and he's done a reasonably effective job at kind of really a balancing act or walking a tightrope tightrope between getting what he thinks the state needs out of the Trump bureaucracy. He's generally had a good relationship with Trump and Pence and other members of the administration. At the same time, when it's useful, he's been able to kind of keep his distance, but he's been generally supportive at this point and, you know, taking a step back when necessary. So I think, you know, it wasn't surprising for me to see Senators Hassan and Shaheen be highly critical and say that the hearings need to be delayed. And it wasn't surprising for me to see Governor Sununu take a little bit of a step back. But he has done a pretty good job at kind of negotiating what's a really a potentially significant minefield in dealing with the administration.
Well, and Gary, Democrats running against or running for the nomination to replace Governor Sununu have been trying mightily to tie the governor with President Trump. Is it working?
It doesn't appear to be working very well. The governor's numbers in the latest few polls show that he's much farther ahead than the president is in terms of the people's favorability in New Hampshire. So it's not an easy tie at all, that's for sure.
There's about a 17-point gap. Yeah, he's up over 17 points over Trump approval.
So it's not an easy thing to do. And, I mean, it's pretty hard. It's always hard to tie a governor to a president. It really is.
Well, the Democrats have been trying. They've been saying, you know, look at this, look at that policy. Let's talk about some of those Democrats running for the gubernatorial nomination and move into the other state primaries, because there are some big, big primaries this year on the Democratic side in the 1st District, on the Republican side in the 2nd District. So we should definitely talk about those guys. But I also want to remind our listeners to join us. It is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions and comments on the top stories of the week. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or call 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, the governor's race. On the Democratic side, two candidates running, Steve Marchand and Molly Kelly. Dean, how would you assess the status of this race? How are these two candidates making their last pitches to voters?
Well, they're both up with campaign advertisements. Each candidate has a autobiographical piece talking about their backgrounds, and Steve Marchand's has the added twist of him speaking in French with subtitles for part of the ad, and he actually talks about trying to tie Trump and Sununu together on a variety of issues. So it's been a pretty vigorous primary. They've been increasingly at odds with each other in recent weeks. Marchand talks about Kelly being part of what he calls Planet Concord, kind of a political insider. Kelly talks about Marchand as someone who really used to be a moderate, but is kind of instrumentally trying to reposition himself as a Sanders-style progressive, and that's not authentic. So it's been a pretty vigorous debate. Whether or not it's going to have a significant impact on Sununu really depends on some of the larger contextual factors in the midterm, you know, whether it's going to be a big blue wave or not.
Well, let's play a little bit of that Steve Marchand ad. It's largely in French, as you said. There's just a little bit of English in here. And Mr. Marchand has been playing up, as you said, Dean, the fact that his parents came to the U.S. from Quebec, that they worked hard. He plays up the role of immigrants and seeks to tie Chris Sununu to President Trump, although, as Gary told us, unsuccessfully. Let's just hear a little bit of that ad to give listeners a flavor of it.
Je m'appelle Steve Marchand. Et je suis Canada au poste du gouverneur de New Hampshire. Mes parents sont des immigrants du Québec. Ils ont travaillé fort.
Okay, so immigrants from Quebec, they worked hard. What do you think of this, Gary, sort of this very concerted effort by Mr. Marchand to play up his French-Canadian roots? He's got the fleur-de-lis on his campaign signs. Do most Granite Staters today still feel that connection?
It probably would have been a lot more effective 40 years ago than it is today. I mean, you had the huge North French Canadian population here, largely in like Manchester and Nashua, and then certainly in the North Country. It's certainly been diluted a lot as we've gotten more diversified here in New Hampshire. It's an interesting ad, and it's certainly going to get people's attention to a certain extent. But I'm not sure it's an ad that the general public is going to react that well to. Although he's trying very hard to bring in this whole idea of immigration and his folks were immigrants from Canada, and they had to work hard, and tying it to what's going on now with the Trump administration. And
so he's trying to modernize this immigrant history here in New Hampshire, and everybody knows the story of immigrants coming to the mills and sort of building the state of New Hampshire and so forth. So
And he's done in black and white, so you get this sort of throwback kind of feel to it. On the other hand, you have Molly Kelly, who's just sort of introducing herself to the people with her ad. And I mean, she's finding out what I think a lot of state senators found out for many times over, which is that they may think they're well-known around the state, but if they're probably pretty well-known about 40% of the people in their district. Outside of that, nobody knows who they are.
Go ahead, Dean. Did you want to jump in on Steve Marchand?
Yeah, it was interesting to see him in the ad try to recast the immigration issue. We know one of the stories we've talked about regularly on the Roundup is this issue of the Border Patrol checkpoints in New Hampshire and how much latitude the Border Patrol should have and how big the, you know, it's a 75-mile range, and there's some suggestion of legislative attempts to shrink that range a little bit. So immigration, Border Patrol, all those issues are, you know, resonating to some extent in New Hampshire as well, and he's kind of trying to recast that as a positive.
Let's talk a little bit more about former State Senator Molly Kelly. And as you said, Gary, she's emphasizing her, you know, hardworking roots, her humble background, and also her refusal to take corporate money. Let's hear a little bit of a recent Molly Kelly ad.
I know how hard it can be to put food on the table. I worked my way through college. I was a young single mom with three small children. Still, I became a financial advisor, then a state senator.
Again, that's an ad from Molly Kelly talking about her hardworking roots. And Gary Reno, how has this campaign between the two of them played out? A lot of people, or a lot of the big groups, have endorsed Senator Kelly, former Senator Kelly. But Steve Marchand is hanging in there.
He is. Poll-wise, they're very close. But
oh, really? Okay.
Pretty close. But I mean, she has a lot more money than he has to play with in the next 3 weeks, which is it's important. I mean, you don't want to put too much emphasis on it, but it's important because of what she can do with that money. You can go up on TV a lot more than he certainly can.
And the big question is going to be, you know, what is going to be the complexion of the primary? Primary voting turnout? Is it going to be, you know, kind of grassroots progressives who maybe view Kelly as kind of a, you know, classic Democratic Party insider? Or is it going to be more the loyal party rank and file who see all these major endorsements from other Democratic elites in the state? And, you know, perhaps that will help her. But, you know, as I've said before, I think the real issue is the bigger context here. You know, by every typical metric we look at, Governor Sununu is in a reasonably good position to be reelected. You know, I think what will determine whether or not that actually happens is the kind of the size of the Democratic turnout. Is there going to be a big blue wave or not? We saw in 2010 with John Lynch and the Tea Party Rebellion, Lynch was literally the last Democrat standing. So New Hampshire does have a history of rewarding governors with Sununu's level of popularity with another term. A lot of it will depend on the size of the reaction to Trump and to these other factors in the election. So I think the Democratic debate has been very good for the party. Whether the candidate is ultimately Marchand or Kelly in the general election, I think there are other factors that are probably going to drive that election.
I think there are a lot of people who are looking at Kelly. This is the year of the woman, and that's why they really wanted to have some woman in a gubernatorial race, and she was more than willing to jump in.
All right. Well, we'll set that aside for now, but I want to remind listeners that they can join us if you want to talk about the Democratic gubernatorial primary or the gubernatorial race overall. We'd love to hear from you. exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dean Spiliotis, you mentioned that John Lynch was the last Democrat standing
in 2010,
and I certainly remember that.
Yeah.
Speaking of former Governor Lynch, he endorsed Chris Pappas this week in the first congressional district Democratic primary. So what did former Governor Lynch have to say about that, and how much does that help Councilor Pappas?
I think it's certainly a nice endorsement to have. Chris Pappas already has Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund and 9 labor unions. He's lined up a lot of endorsements already. John Lynch does not typically endorse like this in a high-profile Democratic primary. I think that was a little bit of a surprise for people. You know, he talked about Chris Pappas's long service to the state, and he talked about his ability to work across the aisle and the potential to provide bipartisan solutions, you know, kind of keeping in sort of the John Lynch ethos of governing. So certainly a nice endorsement to have. I think people had thought, certainly I did and others going into this, that this is really Pappas's primary nomination to lose. I think the Maura Sullivan candidacy and the large amounts of money and outside interest that she's raised was a little bit of a curveball. He still seems to be up, but I think that was sort of a wild card. And you saw kind of Democratic political elites in the state circle around Pappas pretty quickly once it was clear that she was actually a legitimate threat to him getting the nomination.
Well, and this first district Democratic primary is a doozy, Gary. 11 Democrats all wanting that party's nomination. Wow. WMUR and UNH tried to do some polling and good work, but with all those people, I mean, what kind of clarity can you even get from a poll?
It's very hard to get a clarity with that many number of people. I mean, all you're getting really is name recognition at this point, even at this point and late into the campaign. Chris Pappas has more name recognition probably than anyone. And you have some people who probably in any other year would have been a lot more upfront, if you will, people like Mark McKenzie or even Lincoln Soldati to a certain extent, who've been around New Hampshire politics for a long time, and they're just buried down in the heap while Sullivan and Pappas seem to be rising to the top.
Yeah, you actually just mentioned the top four individuals in terms of favorability in the UNH poll. Pappas is 26%, Sullivan at 20%. She actually jumped all the way up from 11% in April. I think she's been spending money. We've seen her television ad in which she talks about her service in the Marines and Iraq and actually gun control. And then McKenzie and Soldati are at 11 and 10%. So and the others are all in single digits. So, you know, this is really just favorability. They're not head-to-head matchups or anything like that. But it does give you a little sense of that our thinking on the race is pretty much in line with what the limited data we have suggests.
Well, and this has happened, you know, in Republican primaries, too. And it's understandable. Everybody's from the same party. So, Gary, you know, they pretty much agree on big issues like guns and health care and immigration. So it's kind of a battle of resumes almost.
A battle of resumes and a battle of residence, kind of, you know. I mean,
now, what do you mean by that?
Well, Maura Sullivan hasn't lived in New Hampshire very long. And I mean, obviously, maybe not, they're not making a huge issue of it in terms of Pappas isn't making a huge issue of it per se, but a lot of other people are. That she hasn't been here long enough. She's been handpicked by the Washington crew to come in here and be the candidate when we can very well pick our own. Thank you.
She had been sizing up a run in Illinois. So this is essentially a targeted opportunity for her.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an issue, I think, that is lying underneath a lot of this, even though she has a lot of money. And if you think back to, I think, when was that? That was quite a while ago. But Jim Craig had been the handpicked guy in the Democratic primary, and Carol Shea Porter came in and won the race handily. And it's, you know, it's a similar sort of situation.
When you said battle of residence, I thought you were going to talk about Maura Sullivan, but I also thought you might talk about, Gary, just the idea that, you know, who is from a population center in this district might help. For example, if you're from Manchester, like Chris Pappas, or if you're from, you know, heavily populated areas in the seacoast, that might be helpful.
Or if, like Levy Sanders, you're from the other
side
of the
state.
Yeah, who is not apparently doing well, if you believe his latest poll, but, you know.
Well, probably not. There are a lot of people who live in Clamont, you know, do very well in the seacoast when they're running for their office there. But
well, it's interesting, and I have learned covering these primary elections like we have this year. We've talked to all the candidates in both parties and in both of these races. I learned, Dean, that you don't have to live in the district. It isn't just Levy Sanders.
No.
We talked to Mr. Burns last week, who's running in the second district on the Republican side. He lives in the first, and he told me there's about 10 or 12 members of Congress who don't actually live in their district.
It's a challenge to pull it off, but that is technically true.
And we've had a few of those before, too.
All right. Well, you learn something new every day. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls and emails, so keep sending them in, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org or 1-800-892-6477.
New Hampshire Public Radio listeners are educated, engaged, and digitally savvy. As an NHPR underwriter, your business can reach this digital audience through our many podcasts, our e-newsletters, or at our award-winning news site, nhpr.org. Learn how you can reach the best and brightest online community in New Hampshire and beyond by visiting the business support page at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Laura Kanoy, in for Peter Biello. Today, we're catching up on the biggest Granite State headlines, and with the state primaries less than 3 weeks away, there's a lot of political news. We're hearing the latest. And then later on in the hour, we'll meet one of those primary candidates, Republican 2nd District Congressional candidate Steve Negrin. Let's get your calls in right now, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. If you have been following some of these very busy primary races for governor, for 1st Congressional District, for 2nd Congressional District, we'd love to take your questions and comments. Send them by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. So, Gary and Dean, let's go to our listeners now. And Jesse's calling in from Keene. Hi, Jesse. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks very much.
Sure.
I really enjoyed your interview with Steve Marchand. Thanks very much. I was able to watch it. It was very touching. He's, I think, a very powerful and informed speaker, and I was lucky enough to see him this week in Keene. He really didn't talk about his opponent at all. And I think you know maybe better than the other panelists. They didn't mention his energy platform, which is extraordinarily strong, an important topic, as you know, this year.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Jesse. And then it's a great question. I know Dean Spiliotis has some thoughts on energy.
A little bit about that commercial that you played. somebody said that the state has become more diversified in its population, and that's kind of funny, but it's still, I think, extraordinary, probably the largest ethnic segment of the state is French-Canadian. And he was honoring his background by playing that ad. I don't think it was a gimmick.
All right.
Great.
And he definitely talks about his French-Canadian heritage a lot, very proud of the hard work that his parents did. And as Gary Reno said, really connecting that immigrant past to the debates of our current times. But I'm glad Jesse mentioned energy, Dean, because I think you and I have talked about this a lot before. Every 2 years, you know, a lot of the issues are the same, pocketbook issues, taxes, national security. But energy, Jesse's right, has really emerged as a big issue in this gubernatorial race. How come?
Well, I think there's been a reinvigorated discussion of energy. Governor Sununu has switched the focus a little bit from renewable energy to a focus more on price of electricity and price of power. Hey, you know, he's not foregoing renewables, but he's sort of shifted the focus in a way that some Democrats believe will actually hold the state back in terms of developing renewable sources of energy. And we have all the debates in the state about pipeline proposals, and it took 8 years to get that Antrim wind farm started. We have Northern Pass is ongoing in the courts. So it's still a big issue. I think there's concern about the direction of our energy policy, and certainly more generally speaking, Steve Marchand has been very programmatic. He's put out a number of different plans on energy and other issues. You know, there's some question about whether or not the typical voter is really going to be that focused on 5-point plans, but certainly worthwhile to get your positions out there. And to the caller's point about whether this is a gimmick or not, the bottom line for
the
bottom line for campaign advertising is you want visibility. You want people talking about your ad.
And here we are talking about it.
Exactly. So, you know, whether it's genuine or a gimmick, if it's effective and people look at it, that's what you need. And so certainly, by me saying it was clever doesn't mean I'm, casting aspersions on it. It was a smart way to get people talking, and it's had that effect.
Well, and speaking of energy, Gary, you're covering issues at the State House. And correct me if I'm wrong, Governor Sununu vetoed two energy-related bills, one on biomass and one on net metering, mm-hmm. generally seen as enhancing solar power. Aren't there veto override sessions planned for this coming up? So that's another reason why it's on the table.
On the table, and I mean, there's a big push by from constituencies from both the net metering and the biomass, bioenergy to override his veto. I mean, you have the whole issue with the wood-burning plants and the wood-burning industry, the logging industry in the North Country that if it gets affected by that. These plants say, if this veto stands, we're going to be closing. On the other hand, the net metering, they were expanding who could do it, and it tends to be a lot of municipalities who are trying to get into it. And so they're trying to push for a veto override, too. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Well, and what's interesting to me about those two bills, Gary, is that this does not seem to be Democrats want this and Republicans want this. There's a lot of shaking out of this issue, not
There's
necessarily
some strange
on party lines.
Fellows here, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
there
we'll...
are. And I mean, and as long as the price of energy is expensive in New Hampshire, and it is, it's mm-hmm. still very high, even though we're actually an exporter of energy, it's always going to be an issue, particularly for business, but also for residential customers.
Right. Well, it's fascinating. I've seen on the biomass plants some reporting that shows you the kind of economic ripple effects of, you know, so the plants can't function. That affects the timber industry. It affects the sale of heavy machinery and on down the line. And I think that's the case that these mayors want to make for an override.
Okay, so when that override session comes, we'll definitely talk about it on the roundup.
September, I think.
Yeah, I'll set that aside for now. But Jesse, thank you so much for putting that issue on the table. And you can join us like Jesse did, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions, comments, thoughts on the news of the week that we're covering on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And guys, we got an email from Jonathan who wants to clarify or add into my question about why Democrats think the Kavanaugh nomination should be postponed. Jonathan says, as things are progressing, more and more analysts are saying they don't know if a sitting president can be indicted on criminal charges. Therefore, the argument is that this is a case that will be going to the Supreme Court, and if that happens, it shouldn't be decided by a Supreme Court justice that was selected by the defendant in the case. That's what Jonathan says. Jonathan says this tit-for-tat, referring to the Merrick Garland process, is dangerous, and it is my hope that the more center-leaning Democrats would balance out Congress so that rules are changed to make the selection process more even, regardless of who the majority party is. And Jonathan, thank you so much for the thought. And I am going to ask Steve Negrin when he's on with us in the last segment of our show. He's a Republican running for the 2nd Congressional District. I'm going to get his thoughts on all the turmoil in Washington over this. But Dean, do you just have some brief thoughts based on what Jonathan said?
Sure, yeah, a couple things came to mind. And I think I mentioned this in my earlier comments. One of the concerns is that that Kavanaugh has this expansive notion of executive power. Some people even suggested that helped Trump ultimately decide on him. He's thinking down the road a little bit. And there's some concern that, you know, would a Justice Kavanaugh recuse himself if the issue of indicting a sitting president were to come before the courts? So this is the concern among people who want to slow down the nomination. I don't think the rules are going to change anytime soon. I think that train has left the station. And, you know, Democrats started it with changing to a majority rule on all appointments below the Supreme Court and cabinet officials. And then obviously with the Republicans, we had the nuclear option around Judge Gorsuch. So I don't see that changing anytime soon. And finally, you have these moderate Democrats in a number of states who are up for re-election where the conservative justices are pretty popular. So they have to be careful about that, given that they're up for re-election.
Well, we got another email from Katie, who says, I was talking to folks up in Wolfboro who are Democrats and asking who they were supporting. They hadn't decided, and I mentioned Lincoln Soldati that I am supporting. And their first comment was, as long as he's not one of those carpetbaggers. Katie says there was huge antipathy towards folks who are not from New Hampshire, like Sanders and Connell. I'm not sure if that's right. I think she means Sullivan. Maybe that's a typo there. And Sanders, in fairness, is from New Hampshire. He's just, right, not, Gary? He just doesn't live in the first
second.
District. He lives in the second
district.
Just
yeah.
like Burns, who lives in the second and is, sorry, lives in the first and is running in the second. But Katie, thank you. Thank you for the point. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk a little bit more, guys, about the 2nd Congressional District. And we here in the Exchange have been talking to all these candidates. We've got our last one coming up in about 10 minutes. Gary, to you first, What are the latest developments in this race? There's some pretty busy campaigning going on there.
It sure is. I mean,
it's about five Republicans running for the nomination to go against Custer.
Yeah, and there are three that have sort of moved to the top, if you will. Blackenbecker, she's a former rep from Concord. Mr. Levinson, who is the whistleblower at the VA, Manchester VA. And the third one is the one that you're going to be talking to this after we leave here, who is also a state rep, Negrin. It's a very interesting race because it's a district that's not that conservative, but these people are all pretty conservative. So it's interesting to see what's happening in a Republican primary where you're having a lot of very conservative duking it out to take on Annie Custer, who's down the road and sitting there with several million dollars in the bank. And it's a very, fairly moderate Democratic-leaning district. So you just wonder, I mean, the primary for these folks in the Republican sector is kind of interesting in that it's going to be a tough sell come November.
Well, Dean, I was talking to one of the candidates last week who, and was saying he was very conservative and very proud of it, and those are his politics, and he was really clear. And I asked him, sort of what Gary said. I said, hey, you've got your beliefs and that's fine, but this is a district that has sent moderate Republicans or Democrats to Congress for a quarter century. How are you going to get around that? He said there are a lot of Trump voters in that district that just haven't bothered to come out, and those are the people I'm going to get and I'm going to win. What do you think?
We'll see.
Does the math add up?
I just made a list of about a half dozen reasons for why this is a tough race for Republicans. Start with favorability. Congresswoman Custer's favorability is at 41%, which is up for her. So she's trending positive in favorability. The favorability numbers for the five Republicans are so low, not because they're unpopular, but simply because people don't know who they are. They're just not particularly well known by the larger electorate, and that's a bigger issue for November rather than the Republican primary. So you got favorability issues. Custer has lots of money, as Gary mentioned. This district, as you said, increasingly leans Democratic, and it's a midterm election year that is likely to be a pretty good year for Democrats. So you put all those things together, it doesn't mean that you couldn't have an upset, but a Republican winning this seat in this year, I think, would be viewed as a bit of an upset. I think Custer definitely has the advantage for all the reasons I just enumerated.
Well, Gary, Republicans often say, in response to that question that I posed this particular candidate, hey, look, Jim Lawrence did pretty well last time around. He was the Republican nominee. I think he got like 45% in the second congressional district, which isn't bad.
And he did, but I mean, it was also you had Trump at the top of the ticket, which
a lot of Trump voters
heavy enthusiasm
for that, and that brought a lot of people out that normally probably wouldn't have come out for that.
All right, let's go back to our listeners, and Larry is on the phone from Keene. Our second caller from Keene today. Hi, Larry. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. My question is, relative to the gubernatorial candidates who are talking a lot about what they would like to do, but in New Hampshire, isn't the governor rather weak because you have the Senate, the House, and the council to deal with? And so that's my first question about process. And then the second part of the question is related to that. And what's going to happen to the Senate and the House and the council in the next election?
Wow, good questions, Larry. And I love the civics-y nature of the first one. Gary, why don't you tackle that? And then, Dean, I want to throw the second part of his question to you because you hosted the show for me last week, so you're good to answer that. But go ahead. He makes a great point. New Hampshire's governorship is typically described as weak, Gary.
It's weak for two reasons, largely. The executive council, where every major contract or any major appointment has to go through the executive council. It's a throwback to the colonial times when they wanted to make sure the governors were held in check.
They didn't become kings.
They didn't want to become kings like they had. And,
right.
And the only two states that still keep it is Massachusetts, where it's meaningless largely, but in New Hampshire it isn't. It's a very powerful group.
And we in Vermont are the only states with two-year terms.
And the other part is the two-year term for governor, so that he's going to run every 2 years. So essentially today, when you win, you got to turn around and start campaigning again. You don't have any long-term things that you can do, you have to do it 2 years at a time. So that does make it for a very weak governor. In New Hampshire, you often have department heads who have four-year terms, so the previous governor is appointing them, so you're going to have to deal with them. They're not your people, they're somebody else's. It's tough for a governor, but, I mean, you have people in the past who have done very well, even despite all the problems.
Sure, because New Hampshire almost always gives the governor a second term, Craig Benson being the outlier a couple years ago. I love his other second question, too, Dean, wondering about the balance of power on New Hampshire's Executive Council, State House, State Senate. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people say more and more with dysfunction in Washington, the real stuff is going to happen in the states, so it matters.
And I would encourage Larry to listen to the podcast from Monday's show.
Absolutely.
I had two great experts on talking for an hour about precisely this question. And, you know, just the thumbnail sketch of what we discussed was the first on the House, the potential for, you know, potentially a significant Democratic swing, but just a sense that the House is often quite unpredictable because you have 400 members and there's typically a fair bit of turnover, but that if this is a Democratic year, there could be some ripple effect in the House. And with Democrats picking up a number of seats, and that would have a variety of impacts on the governor's legislative agenda should he be reelected. The Senate, we talked a bit about the impact of gerrymandering. You tend not to see quite as big swings in the Senate. We talked about two or three seats that were fairly close in the last presidential election between Trump and Clinton, so maybe there's potential there. And on the Executive Council, right now it's 3-2 in favor of Republicans. Chris Pappas is vacating his seat, so there's a big slate of candidates on both sides to try to get that seat. And then also the one other seat, I believe David Wheeler, Deborah Pignatelli.
Oh, they've traded that seat back and forth a couple times.
Is back in the race again. So that may be an opportunity for Democrats to get a pickup. We'll see.
Well, pretty serious news this week. Could we please end on a lighter note? And I think you guys know where I'm going to go. Sometimes it's the little things in life that get you down. In this case, it's when the deli clerk at the grocery store puts the price sticker right on that sliding zipper of the plastic bag, basically ruining the function of that well-sealed bag. Who brought this terrible problem to the forefront, Gary?
Well, Kevin Smith, who's been around politics here in New Hampshire for a long time, he's now the Londonderry town manager, tweeted out how upset he was that they keep putting the price sticker over the Ziploc that closed the bags for the deli bags.
And then it ruins the Ziploc. He was very polite. Right. He said, love you, Market Basket, but.
But. And then Chris Sununu took up the whole thing. This is probably Chris Sununu's biggest accomplishment since he's been governor in a lot of ways.
You're being facetious here, Gary, I hope. Kindergarten and all that other stuff, governor would say. But he, this got funny. And a lot of people like, yeah, that drives me crazy, too. Let's hear a little bit from the governor about this on WLNH's, credit to them, morning wake-up program.
The bag rips. And my frustration, as I expressed on Twitter or Facebook, whatever it was, I said, well, then I have to buy Ziploc bags to reseal the cheese, and that takes away all the cost advantage of going to Market Basket in the first place.
Okay, so a vote for fresh cheese from the governor there. Real quick, Gary Randall, what are you going to be covering next week besides whether Market Basket follows through with this promise tonight?
Another transmission project is in the works. We're going to adjudicative hearings for this Seacoast reliability project that Eversource is doing. It's not as controversial in any as Northern Pass, but there is a controversy considering how they're going to go over Little Bay or under Little Bay and how they're going to do that.
Okay, so. Wow. Well, you have to come back and talk to us about that because these projects generate a lot of interest. How about you, Dean? Last week of August, hard to believe.
Hard to believe is right. We're a little over 3 weeks out from the primaries on September 11th, so it's all electoral politics all the time at this point. Lots of debates, lots of campaigning, plenty of candidates to still check out.
In other words, Christmas time for Dean
Stiliotis. Right. Right through November.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. Really nice to see you.
Thanks, Laura.
And coming up, we're going to talk with 2nd Congressional District Republican candidate Steve Negrin. That will be on Facebook Live as well, so you can watch and listen to our interview. Stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or Subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.